Welcome to the Global Governance Podcast, where we explore the future of governance. Each episode will look at a different global issue and how governance plays a key role in its solution. From climate change to gender equality, from corruption to peace and security, we invite experts to explore a thought-provoking game of what if and why not, positing a world in much closer international cooperation. And now your host, Augusto López Claros. Enjoy.
Michael Mandelbaum is the Christian Herter Professor of American Foreign Policy at the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies in Washington, D.C., and he is the director of the American Foreign Policy Program there. He has also held teaching posts at Harvard and Columbia Universities and at the United States Naval Academy. His most recent book, published in 2022, is titled The Four Ages of American Policy: Weak Power, Great Power, Superpower, Hyperpower. Professor Mandelbaum is moreover the author or co-author of numerous articles and of 13 books, among them The Rise and Fall of Peace on Earth, Mission Failure, America and the World War in the Post-Cold War Era, The Road to Global Prosperity, and That Used to Be Us, How America Fell Behind in the World It Invented and How We Can Come Back, with co-author Thomas Friedman. Michael, we're grateful that you have agreed to be our guest for today's Global Governance Forum podcast. Much has happened since we last spoke in the summer of 2022, and I think it would be useful to explore several issues which I think are likely to remain very topical in coming years. Let me begin perhaps at an obvious point, which is asking you about the war in the Ukraine. Help our listeners understand why the Russian government, in its decision to invade Ukraine, saw the country as a threat to its security. The very idea seems ludicrous to many of us in the West. But Russia is apparently willing to bear the heavy cost of sanctions and the resulting devastation of its economy, not to say the death of tens of thousands of its young people, for a war that seems to provide it with no apparent strategic benefits. My question to you, is this just another example of the miscalculations that sometimes authoritarian regimes make because there is no scope within those governments or societies for internal debate, for consultation, which often are important elements of preventing big blunders?
It is certainly an example of miscalculation, and miscalculation, as you say, of the kind to which authoritarian regimes are susceptible. There's a social science maxim that high coercion systems are low information systems, if only because underlings don't want to bring bad news to the man in charge. They want to tell him what he wants to hear. And apparently that's what happened with Putin and Ukraine. He seems to have believed that it would be a walkover, a stroll in the park, that it would all be over in 24 hours, that the Ukrainian government would flee or be captured and killed, that Russia would take control of the capital, Kyiv, and thus of the entire country, and that he could make a triumphal entry into Ukraine in just a few days, the way Hitler did to Paris after the Wehrmacht conquered France in 1940. Well, the Ukrainian people had other ideas. They stopped the Russian military effort. They pushed back the Russians. They have been fighting vigorously and bravely for more than 500 days now, and the war has become extraordinarily costly to Russia and to Putin personally. That, I suppose, raises two questions. First, why did he want to do it in the first place? And here I think we just have a case of good old-fashioned imperialism. He wanted to grab territory. He thinks of Russia as an historic great power. that should be as large geographically as possible. Ukraine was part of a Russian-dominated political entity for more than 300 years. And so Putin thought that he would just restore that status quo. He was greedy for power, and he thought that he would get away with it, and this would ensure that he went down in the annals of Russian history as a great conqueror. It would be nice if all leaders believed in the rule of law, in respecting national sovereignty and human rights, in peace as the most desirable state of affairs and international affairs. But unfortunately, not all leaders do believe that. And Vladimir Putin is perhaps the most conspicuous exception, but unfortunately, he's not the only one. And because Russia is an autocratic regime, there was no way of preventing him from attacking Ukraine once he decided to do so. The other, I suppose, obvious or at least important question is, now that his initial effort has failed, now that the attack on Ukraine has proved to be anything but cost-free for Russia, why doesn't he reconsider? Why doesn't he stop? Well, maybe at some point he will, but here I think the problem is that he is stuck in the sense that if he abandons his stated goals, if he just gives up and goes home with the Russian army, this will likely be very bad for him personally. Although Russia is a dictatorship and an autocracy, the Russian people and perhaps the Russian army and in the security organs that he depends on to stay in power will think, well, what was that all about? What was that for? Why should we have somebody who's made such a colossal mistake at the head of our country? So I think he may well calculate that to admit failure and go home is to risk his own position and perhaps his own life. So therefore, he risks the lives of tens of thousands of other people to protect his own. And it seems that he is in a position in which he can't succeed. That is, he's not going to succeed in conquering Ukraine because of the determination of the Ukrainian people and the help that the Ukrainians have received from the West. So he can't succeed, but he can't afford to fail, or at least can't afford to admit failure, stop the war, and bring his troops home. So we're stuck with what seems to be a bloody, destructive, and seemingly open-ended war.
So he painted himself into a corner, and he doesn't know how to get out. Yeah. Michael, some scholars in the West have argued that perhaps the real threat to Russia is, of course, not military. The argument, which I find very, very plausible, goes as follows. An independent Ukraine, firmly anchored in European values, that means democracy, respect for human rights and the rule of law, a free and independent press, a judicial system that is free from telephone calls from the executive and so on. And to add to this, eventually free to join, other countries in Central and Eastern Europe and the European Union, that is the real political threat to Russia's current system of governance. In particular, it shows Russian people, the voters, that there is a viable alternative to authoritarianism, that no one in the West is out to destroy them in the same way that no one is out to destroy India or to destroy Brazil or some other sovereign nation. My question to you is, do you broadly agree with this view, or is it just a simplified take on what is a very complex problem?
I do broadly agree with it. Certainly, Russia faced no military threat from Ukraine. Putin liked to claim that Ukraine was about to join NATO and that that would pose a military threat to Russia. But that's nonsense on two counts. First, NATO is not an aggressive organization and it had no thought of ever invading Russia. But second, NATO was not going to welcome Ukraine into its ranks before February 22nd, 2022. Putin certainly knew that or should have known it because he was spending some time talking with the French president, Emmanuel Macron, and Macron was opposed to bringing Ukraine into NATO at that point, and Macron has a veto. So the excuse is nonsense. I do think it is the case that the great threat to Putin and his regime and his cohort of people who dominate the security services and the economy, and let's not forget that all of them have enriched themselves by being in power. They have a lot to lose, a lot of wealth to lose, if this regime is replaced. They do, I believe, fear a Western Ukraine because they fear the example of the West. They fear a democratically elected government. They fear the rule of law. They fear a free market economy. They fear anti-corruption efforts because they are essentially and quintessentially corrupt. So beginning with the Orange Revolution in 2004, where the Russians and some in Ukraine tried to steal the election from a pro-Western presidential candidate, and the Ukrainians went into the streets to prevent that, Putin, I believe, has had on his mind the danger of Ukraine gravitating into the Western camp, the Western orbit, and the Western and Western civilization, because that does pose a mortal threat to him. And of course, the majority of Ukrainians were interested in doing precisely that. And now, by attacking Ukraine, Putin has more or less ensured that this is what will happen with Ukraine.
I guess in the same way that he has been directly responsible, I guess, for the entry of Finland and Sweden into NATO, right? It's been sort of exactly the opposite of the intended outcome. Let me shift gears a little bit and raise sort of two or three issues under the sort of general heading of what I will call global catastrophic risks that we are currently facing as a human family. And let me begin by pointing something that you yourself may have seen. Last October, the United Nations Environment Program published its annual emissions report, titled The Closing Window, in which that is meant to be a reference to the report's main conclusion, namely that there is no credible pathway to 1.5 degrees centigrade. You know very much what's happening. That has been widely commented in the press. We have failed to reduce carbon emissions. And now organizations like the UNEP, you know, are basically saying that unless we make rapid transformations of our societies, we are on a very dangerous path to all kinds of environmental calamities. You have written on climate issues, and my question is, you know, are you sort of aligned with the sort of increasingly dire assessments made by the scientific community? UNEP is an example, but there is also the last report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Is it in fact too late to prevent some of the worst consequences of climate change?
Well, not being a scientist, I don't have an expert view of the studies. I do think that there is a fair amount of uncertainty, despite and in some ways because of the various climate studies. I think it's certainly possible to read the studies and think that the consequences, the social and economic consequences of a rise in global temperature may not be as dire as some fear, but because there's so much uncertainty, they could also conceivably be worse. So it's certainly a good idea to reduce the rise in the world's climate, which means reducing greenhouse emissions. But it certainly does not look at this point as if the world is going to take the steps necessary to achieve substantial reductions. And that's, I think, for two broad reasons. First, although governments in the developed West take this problem seriously, they have not been able to put in place policies that will substantially lower their own greenhouse gas emissions. And the reason for that, I think, is that these governments have not persuaded their publics that this is a dire threat, that unless radical steps are taken, there will be serious adverse consequences soon for everybody. Certainly, the American government has not succeeded in persuading the American people that they have to take serious steps now to reduce greenhouse emissions. So that's one problem. The other problem is that just as the governments and the publics of the rich countries have not become sufficiently persuaded, so the governments of developing countries have not been persuaded that they have to take urgent and far-reaching steps now. And they have a very powerful disincentive to take those steps, that being the fact that they are poor and that increasing the material well-being of their people, which is a goal of all of them, no matter what kind of government they have, in the past and in the present, requires greater energy consumption, which means greater carbohydrate consumption, which means greater greenhouse emissions. In fact, so far from helping to solve the problem, they're making it worse, especially China. I read somewhere that China's plans, its energy plans, call for the building of more capacity for coal-fired electricity generating plants over the next 10 years than exist in the entire rest of the world. So far from giving up carbohydrates, China is doubling down on them. In both kinds of countries, it doesn't look as if the world is on a path to get to a situation below a 2.5 centigrade rise in global temperatures. I should say that as far as I can tell, there are at least three things that Western governments, and especially the American government, should be doing now, which for various reasons it is not doing, even though the American federal government is currently controlled by the Democratic Party, which is committed, at least rhetorically, to doing something about global warming. The first necessary step is to put a price on carbon, and the Europeans have taken some serious steps in that direction, but the United States has not. We need carbon taxes. All economists of whatever political persuasion agree that that's the best way to reduce greenhouse gases, but that isn't happening here. The second necessary step, or so it seems to me, to reduce dependence on carbohydrates is to increase the use of nuclear power. Now, nuclear power brings with it serious problems, but the fact is that in terms of greenhouse emission, it's relatively clean. And if the world is going to continue to generate electricity in large volume, and it certainly is going to do that if it can, it needs to find a cleaner way to do so. And the most efficient clean way to do it, the one that can most easily be scaled, is nuclear energy. The third necessary step, it seems to me, is to invest far more than is now the case in research and development on clean energy technology. The reason being that countries, especially countries of the third world, will not abandon carbon-based fuels unless they have the technology to generate the power that they need at roughly the same cost without using coal and other carbon-based fuels. So if we are going to be saved, if salvation is what we need, it's going to be technological innovation that will do it. And therefore, we in the rich world have to invest far more in research and development on energy technology than we are currently doing.
Thank you, Michael. That's a very compelling answer and very persuasive as well. Let me move on to a second area of risk to our future. And I refer in particular to what I call the unraveling of our nuclear order in recent decades. As you know, quite a bit of progress was made by the US and Russia at the end of the Cold War in nuclear arms reductions. However, more recently, to take an example, in 2021, the US decided to withdraw from the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty. And last year, Russia announced that it would suspend participation in the New START Treaty, which is the last remaining nuclear arms control agreement in effect. Furthermore, perhaps this is not so well known, but the Treaty on the Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons, which is the most comprehensive treaty that we have left, has an article which actually explicitly calls for, and I quote, negotiations in good faith aimed at the cessation of the arms race, leading to ultimate nuclear disarmament. But instead, what we see is exactly the opposite, as you well know. The nuclear powers are modernizing their arsenals. They are expanding them. The data for 2021 shows $82 billion being spent for this purpose, improving or modernizing the global nuclear weapons among the powers, the nuclear powers. This bulletin of nuclear scientists and their doomsday clock, and in January of this year they set it at 90 seconds to midnight, which, according to what they said, is the closest humanity has been to Armageddon. So is this yet another source of huge risk to our future, perhaps of a similar scale to climate change or not?
Nuclear weapons have posed a serious threat to the whole world ever since they were first invented and used in 1945. And it is remarkable and a blessing that the world has managed since then to avoid a nuclear shot being fired in anger. The deterioration of the world's nuclear circumstances is due to the deterioration in relations between the United States and Russia. Nuclear circumstances depend on political relationships. Politics is the independent variable, and nuclear weapons are the dependent variable. The far-reaching arms control agreements that the United States and first the Soviet Union and then post-Soviet Russia reached came about at the end of the Cold War when and because the political rivalry was ending. Now that the political rivalry has resumed, and I blame this mostly on Mr. Putin, now that it has resumed, nuclear cooperation, nuclear reductions are no longer on the agenda. Nuclear proliferation, that is the spread of nuclear weapons to countries that do not possess them, is also a serious threat. And it's generally been thought that the wider nuclear weapons spread in the international community, the more countries that come to possess them, the greater will be the chances of a nuclear shot fired in anger, that is, of a nuclear war. And here, I think there is a very serious threat that I think probably gets less attention than it deserves, and that is the Iranian nuclear program. The Iranians seem determined to get the bomb, and the end of the joint agreement with the United States may have accelerated the Iranian timetable, but that agreement was never going to stop the Iranians from producing nuclear weapons. And that's dangerous, not only because Iran is an aggressive and conceivably unstable regime, but also because it's entirely possible, indeed I would say even likely, that if Iran gets the bomb, other countries in the Middle East will also want to get the bomb. Saudi Arabia has already said that it wants nuclear weapons. Turkey might well follow suit. Egypt would not wish to be left out either. Even some of the small Gulf countries have enough money to buy one if a country is willing to sell. And that means that there will be multiple centers of nuclear control in a small region where there are not great distances separating the opposing nuclear forces, as was the case during the Soviet-American nuclear standoff during the Cold War, when, as a consequence, nuclear arsenals may well be on hair trigger alert. Countries will calculate that they are in a position of what is called use them or lose them. They can't afford to be attacked. They have to shoot first in nuclear terms. And that's a very dangerous situation. Moreover, if other countries, such as Saudi Arabia, acquire nuclear weapons, that will be a signal that they no longer regard the American nuclear deterrent as credible. And since there are many countries in Europe and in Asia that depend on the American nuclear deterrent against Russia in Europe and against China in Asia, these countries, and there are many of them, if they conclude that they cannot rely on the United States, will likely be moved to get nuclear weapons themselves. And so the result of an Iranian nuclear weapon could be what is sometimes called a cascade of nuclear weapons around the world, and that will make the world a far more dangerous place.
You know, your comments on this issue remind me of the warnings made by Jonathan Schell a little more than 40 years ago in The Fate of the Earth. And not much has changed in that 40-year period in terms of the, you know, the risks posed for our future as a result of what's happening on this on this front. Michael, I spent a good part of the last decade at the World Bank as the head of one of the research teams, and a recent report last year, actually, put out by the World Bank said that the pandemic caused the largest increase in global inequality since the end of World War II, with the bottom 40% of the income distribution suffering a much larger shock and recovering more slowly than the top 60%. This is a major concern to me in particular as an economist because of the well-established negative connection between increases in income inequality on the one hand and political stability and the resilience of democratic institutions of governance on the other. All the latest research that I have read, you know, basically provides compelling evidence on this relationship. It seems to me that income inequality has ceased to be merely an economic problem, you know, amenable to be corrected by better public policies, and has now mutated into a social and political problem that I think could undermine the very basis of our democracy, or democracy in many parts of the world. And I think that this problem, you know, has raised multiple questions about our economic system. It's resilient to shocks, whether it's on a sustainable path, and so on. My question to you, and I realize that, you know, this is not going to be about the technicalities of how you measure inequality, but more generally, why are we as a sort of society in the US and elsewhere failing so abysmally to address this problem? Let me add a small footnote. I did a podcast a couple of months ago with a member of the Argentinian parliament, and he made the point to me that two points. Latin America, he said, is the most violent continent in the world, number one. It's also the most unequal in the world. And then he made a very compelling argument for the connection between the two.
Well, I think that income inequality within particular countries necessarily falls to the responsibility of the political system of that particular country. I'm not sure that there's much that the world can do from the outside about inequality in Argentina or Brazil. But it's in part a political problem of particular countries, certainly including the United States. And the reasons for the relative inattention to the problem of inequality are, I think, political and probably particular to individual countries. Argentina is not the same as Brazil in this regard, and both of them differ from the United States. But one thing I think we can say is that the problem of economic inequality becomes easier, or at least more feasible, to address constructively to the extent that countries are experiencing economic growth, because then there's a bigger pie to redistribute. But economic growth has not been robust recently for a whole host of reasons, of which the pandemic is certainly a major one. There's also been a retreat from globalization, and globalization was a great blessing for poorer countries. So I think to the extent that we as an international system can find ways to increase economic growth, that will be relevant to the problem that individual countries face of trying to redress economic inequality as a way of promoting political stability and political democracy.
Thank you, Michael, for that very interesting insight. Let me come to the last question in this very fascinating podcast. And it is often, not always, but it's often is my last question is an area where I try to go a little bit further from the mainstream and raise perhaps some you know additional important issue. You may have heard that for the first time since the UN was created, there is talk of holding a UN Charter Review Conference, as called in Article 109 of the Charter, which was introduced in San Francisco in 1945 to placate the concerns of countries like New Zealand, Mexico, and others, you know, with the introduction of the veto in the UN Charter. One of these high-level advisory boards appointed by the UN Secretary General, Mr. Gutierrez, to advise him on the program for the 2024 Summit of the Future basically said, you know, and I quote, "The Summit of the Future is an opportunity to reaffirm our commitment to the UN Charter and announce a charter review conference focused on Security Council reform." I have thought a great deal about this issue of the veto, you know, and you very often hear arguments to the effect that the permanent members of the Security Council would never willingly give up the veto, independently of the fact that it has turned the Security Council, you know, into a dysfunctional institution within the UN system and actually led to a gradual transfer of power and influence to the General Assembly. From my perspective, I don't know whether you agree with this, but the veto in recent decades has become a kind of an increasingly devalued privilege. It seems to be more an ancient symbol, no, of the kind of power and political arrangements that were put in place at the end of World War II. And in fact, just let me illustrate this with a recent example. You know that after the invasion of Ukraine February in 2022, there was an immediate attempt to have the Security Council issue a strongly worded resolution. The Russians vetoed it. It went immediately to the General Assembly, and in the General Assembly, they issued their own resolution, which was even stronger. And by a vote of 141-5, you know, they basically told the Russians to get out. They said to immediately cease its use of force against Ukraine, and so on. And my argument here is that the use of the veto by Russia in the Security Council was not worth very much because it did not prevent NATO and other countries from coming to the assistance of Ukraine so that they could defend themselves against Russian aggression. So for me, my question then is, if the veto indeed is not worth as much as it used to be, or perhaps it's not worth very much these days, but countries continue to cling to it, the permanent members, will we see the UN increasingly sidelined in times of conflict, with real power and influence moving, you know, to other centers, and the UN performing the role of helpless bystander, which was not the intention of the founders of the United Nations? And so my question to you, and I'm being deliberately provocative perhaps, you know, are we witnessing the dying pangs of either the veto or maybe the UN itself as we know it?
The UN has operated under a handicap from the very beginning. And that handicap is that countries, sovereign states, are jealous of their sovereignty. And they are not going to give up the right to decide for themselves their own policies on major questions to an international body. And this is true of, in particular, of powerful countries. This is an occupational defect of any international organization. The UN can't force any country to do anything. It doesn't have its own military. There have been various attempts to organize a special UN force, but they've had very limited success. And I think that will be true for as far into the future as we can see. If the United States or Russia or China or India doesn't wish to comply with a UN resolution, whether it's a Security Council resolution or a General Assembly resolution, those countries will not comply, and the UN cannot make them comply. So there are and have been serious limits to what the UN can do from the very beginning. When the UN was organized, its founders, especially the American government, had very much in mind the precedent of the League of Nations, which was organized after World War I, whose great champion was the American president Woodrow Wilson, who, however, could not persuade the United States to join. He could not get the United States Senate to ratify the League Charter. And at the core of the refusal of the United States Senate to ratify the League Charter was Wilson's inability to answer the question of whether, if the United States subscribed to the League Charter, and especially to Article 10, which provided for resisting aggression, whether that would dilute American sovereignty, whether if the League voted to take military action against an aggressor, the United States would be obliged to join. That, of course, contradicted the American Constitution, which holds that only the American Senate has the right to declare war for the United States. And Americans were not willing to give up sovereignty and did not join the League. So when the United Nations was created, there was a bow to the fact that some countries are more powerful than others in the creation of the Security Council, but there was also a bow to the fact that powerful countries will not do what the United Nations wants them to do if they don't want to, in the form of the veto. All of which is a long-winded way of saying that I'm not sure the abolition of the veto would make much difference. Supposing there were no veto in the Security Council and Russia had stood alone in vetoing the Security Council's condemnation of its own invasion of Ukraine. Perhaps China would have abstained, but that such a resolution would certainly have passed in the absence of a veto. How much difference would that have made? Would the Russians have said, oh, well, if the Security Council is against this, we'll bow to its wishes and get out of Ukraine? I fear not. So I think we have the United Nations we have, and we have the limitations on the United Nations, which really have obtained since 1945 because of the persistence of the age-old institution of national sovereignty, which powerful countries show no real sign of being willing to give up.
Are you optimistic that perhaps in coming years, as you know, we are hit by climate change, by growing military tensions between the superpowers, by social and economic problems such as that of inequality, which we have discussed, there might be more of a willingness on the part of the larger countries to rethink the UN Charter simply because they feel that nothing else is working and that we need to perhaps establish a new foundation, as we did in 1945, for a kind of a revamp of global order?
Well, it's certainly possible. It's, I think, a sad historical fact that what causes nations and their leaders to change their minds substantially on major issues is disaster. That was true of the two world wars of the last century. And if comparable disasters occur in this century, they will certainly generate a lot of discussion about how to prevent them in the future, which necessarily will lead to a reconsideration of the institutes and practices that had been in place before the disasters and had either failed to prevent those disasters or even caused them. So we might see a very different kind of global organization in the wake of a disaster comparable to the two world wars of the first half of the last century. But that would be a very high price to pay. I don't think that it would be worth it, or that it would likely not be worth it to suffer the destruction of a disaster in order to get people and governments seriously to rethink how they do business with one another.
Thank you for listening to the Global Governance Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with friends and family. To learn more, please visit globalgovernanceforum.org and join the conversation.